introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I have to introduce myself? Okay, it's May Pang from New York, and I'm talking to you, Dennis the Menace, for this Beatles show.
Oh, is this a Beatles? Oh, it is. I thought this was a May Pang show. I didn't know this was a Beatles show.
One person just recently asked on my Facebook, they said, I know you were with John, but the Beatles broke up. How did you meet them? So it was kind of an interesting little, you know, question to me. And I said, yes, I've met them, but they were all around. So I've met, I knew all of them, actually. But I met George I met in New York before John. So I worked in the office. People forget I worked at Apple.
Yeah, so let's go there. Let's circle back.
Well, the only thing is that I worked at Alan Klein's office, although people have a hard time thinking, oh, here's that guy, you know, he's got a bad rap. But a lot of people don't know that if it wasn't for Klein, there was a lot of things that were changing the recording contracts because of him that was in favor of the artists, against the record company. And on top of that, he was a big philanthropist. I mean, I know a lot of... I know people that were benefited by his, you know, he would go to a lot of those charity events and he would do the silent auction, buy it. And I know somebody who's a photographer, a very well-known one, and he paid for the operation, not asking for anything back.
Well, tell me about your history. You were born in New York.
I was born in New York. I was born in Harlem. I was raised in Harlem, in Spanish Harlem. I come from a family where I'm the only one of the first cousins, okay? Everybody else was born in China except me. The most important is the fact that music really saved my life. Music saved me, touched me, and then I love music. So that's what I listened to. If anybody could remember the transistor radio, that used to be attached to my ear practically, morning, noon, and night. And then, the Beatles came on the scene, and it just took me by surprise, you know, like I did the rest of the world. And I followed them, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great one day that, you know, I could work for them? And that's just a dream, because I was just so, you know, I think it was every girl's dream. But again, I think they're the guardian angels were out there, because that was my first job. I went to Alan Klein's office, and being there at the right time in the right place, and got a job.
The Beatles are raised above everybody else, and they're not allowed to be human in many ways.
Right. And that's what John used to complain about. You know, whatever thoughts he may have had one day on Sunday, by Wednesday he could be another thought. And they're saying, but you said this. And he says, am I not allowed to change? And George used to come to his defense. But the thing is... the Beatles that were different than the Stones or any other rock and roll band, and people don't know of this age because we're so far away now, but at that time, the difference is they changed rock and roll music and the pop culture. So it wasn't just their music and we listened to a record and they made it to number one or whatever. It was whatever they said, how they dress, how they looked, who they spoke to, what they were into, just changed the whole generation. So from that, that's why that long hair came in. All of a sudden, that we went to the Maharishi when we wanted to. We were getting to Nehru jackets. So whatever, they were the pioneers. So this is a change of culture as well as, you know, it's not just music. So, I mean, they did their thing. And what was unique about their music, and people who don't realize this, is that every album they did something different that nobody else had done before. I mean, they didn't have the orchestral music. They did everything from, what was it, Sgt. Pepper was a four-track.
So you were in Alan Klein's office, and you obviously had, you know, connections with, obviously, all the Beatles at once, because they were in and out.
Except for Paul. I had the first Beatle to ever grace that place, and I was working in music publishing, which I love. I was at first like a gopher. They were trying to find a space to put me in. And then my love for music publishing, it had always been, and it still is. The first Beatle that ever walked in was my favorite, Ringo. And then after that was George, and I remember George Harrison coming into town with Patty and carrying under his arm the 2-inch master of All Things Must Pass. So I remember that he brought his the disc cutter from Apple, and, you know, of course it's what they call mastering engineer, named George Peckham, and just to oversee what was happening in America, you know, in New York. And it was good that he brought him over to be the eyes and ears of what was happening in the mastering room. And so that was the second Beatle. And of course, the third Beatle, it was all happening in 1 year, in 1970. Oh God, that's so long ago. In December, I then had, John and Yoko. They came into town.
And I'm going to ask this as directly as I can. So this man and this woman come walking in. They're iconic. He's definitively iconic. She's iconic by association. And your reaction to her was?
I didn't have a reaction. My reaction is one.
It's a unit.
It was a unit at that moment, absolutely. And I'm thinking, I remember my girlfriend saying to me, and we were coming to work, because we always used to come to work early, and I said, she says, what are they doing here? I said, who are you talking about? She goes, look up and see who's leaning against the wall waiting for the elevator. And I saw them and I went, oh my God. And so, you know, nobody said anything. Nobody bothered them. And the way they looked, they were dressed very toned down. It's that the look, that the real scruffy look, the one that was on the Rolling Stone cover where he's, you know, just came out of Primal Therapy and, this, you know, he's in his overall jeans and haven't shaved for God knows how long. You have him, you have Yoko, who's in the background and, I'm dressed all in black and short hair. And, you know, it was interesting. They were here to do two films, Fly and Up Your Legs Forever.
So where was that moment where the two of you...
A lot of people don't realize this. They were having a lot of problems within their own marriage. And so in 1973, everybody knew, you know, there was something going on. But, you know, in 1973, as I'm sitting in my office, she approaches me. She goes, I think it's time. You know, John's going to start seeing other people.
She came to you and said that. That's incredible.
Well, you know what? Everybody in the house knew something. So I just sort of said, okay. And I'm thinking, he's going to start seeing other people. Maybe we should, I'm having a hard time dealing with this. I'm thinking, John, Yoko, and an X Factor is now come to light. And then she looks at me, but you don't have a boyfriend. And I said, okay, I'm not looking for one. And she says, I think it'd be good if you, because you're really... You fit, you know, you...
So you're telling me, this is quite amazing, that Yoko was casting you.
Yes, and I said no. I said, she goes, but I know you're not looking for him. I know you're not after him. I said, I'm not. I don't want, you know, when you work for somebody, I worked for them at that point, like 3 years. You know somebody. I'm not interested.
This is trouble, yeah.
I don't want this. And so she says, oh, you should. And she said, you will. And I said, no. And she walked out of the room. And I'm going, oh, God, what is this now? And, you know, as time went on, I refused. And she was hoping, because we were in the middle of doing his album, Mind Games. So at the end of the day, I wouldn't go. And then it was like time had passed. We kept canceling the studio. Finally, John, she came to me, she goes, John wants to go to the studio today. I said, okay. And I said, I will. You know, that's fine. They acted like nothing happened. And he'd come in, he says, you have all the paperwork? I said, yes, because I did all the work. And all the, you know, everything was done. And as we got into the elevator, as the door closed, he turned around, he grabbed me, and he kissed me. And I just looked at him, and I said, stand over to the other side of the elevator. Don't come near me. And he's like looking. He goes, I've been waiting to do this all day. I said, I don't care. Just stand on the other side of the elevator. So it was really not because Yoko's asked me at that point. It really was John who pursued me. And that's where it's that blur line, but that's where it is, because I wouldn't go.
But you don't know that they didn't have conversations in some way, shape, or form.
He did tell me. She came to him afterwards and said, why don't, you know, I think you could go out. You should go out with May. And he's going, what, are you kidding me? And he didn't want to come out of his room. So the two of us are in, he's in his bedroom not wanting to come out. I'm in my office not wanting to come. So we don't have to face each other after. And she's having a great laugh in the middle. But the thing is, as time went on, you know, he later said to me, he goes, she was pushing so much that she says, you know what? It's time. I'm just going to go for it. It's not a bad idea. And, you know, and so he came after me. So he was more persuasive.
That's a hilarious story. That's just absolutely crazy.
But of course, then after we got together, the first time we got together, he wrote the song Surprise, Surprise, Sweet Bird of Paradise, which of course ended up on the Walls and Bridges album. And that whole album was really all John, everything from production and everything. And it was John's only number one album with a number one single in his lifetime.
That's crazy.
And it's me singing. You know that. It's me singing Number Nine Dream, which a lot of people didn't know. And, you know, when I see a video these days, you know, and I see the video that's out there that was put together, obviously after John died, of Number Nine Dream, it's Yoko mouthing, but it's my vocal.
Okay, so where was the East Coast to West Coast transition? How did that occur?
Well, again, it's the myth that everybody thinks that Yoko sent us out, you know, and it wasn't. John just thought at one point his lawyer came out and was talking to him at the Dakota, and Yoko was out of town, actually. And so he turned to his lawyer and he said, okay, Harold, when are you going back to L.A.? Because that's where he was stationed. So he says, I'm going back tonight. And this was like maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, okay, guess what? I want to go out to L.A. May and I will be joining you. Now, he had no idea what was happening. And it's like, okay, and he never asked. And so that's how it started. So we just literally picked up. John felt that he wanted us to have a break and be on our own so that there'd be nobody else around us. So we went back to L.A. Nobody knew we were out there. In fact, we were another myth, you know, because I know there are people that claim that they picked us up, like Elliot Mintz, but he didn't pick us up until another time we came out. But Harold arranged friends to pick us up. Had no idea who they were picking up, you know, had no idea. And he said, so where are you guys staying? We said, we haven't thought about that far except getting on a plane with you. And he said, okay, well, guess what? You'll stay at my apartment and I'll find someplace else. And we said, are you kidding? He said, no, you stay here.
This infamous house that all of this craziness went on.
You know what the thing is? It was several houses that we were at. And everybody's crazy. Everybody has their viewpoints. And I'm the only one, the straight one, that's watching it. And I love how everybody likes to say, John was drunk. And I'm looking at them and say, oh, man, this is what happened. They don't even know what happened. I'm the one watching this. I'm the only one that's straight to see the whole thing. And everybody blames, you know, it was John. I said, they don't take any of the blame themselves. And I'm looking at this musician. They were all having the time of their life. But you know what? And I look at it, who makes the better copy? Those musicians or John Lennon in a newspaper?
Yeah, but there was quite the cast of characters, needless to say.
There was definitely a cast of characters. Not every night did we go out, because I could tell you, John would say, I can't do it every night. I don't understand how these guys could do it. And you know, when they were out, it was the boys, you know, it was the gang. But, you know, John had a tendency to forget that the one that was the most famous in that group was him. So they were all watching him. They didn't care about anybody else in the band. And I'm sitting there going, I think we better stop. And Harry Nilsson, I mean, I love Harry, but he was the biggest instigator of the lot.
I have to go here. The infamous contract that ended the Beatles. You were involved there, were you not?
The contract was supposed to be signed originally, and it's a stack. It's not one contract. People don't understand. It's like a stack that's like yay high. Yeah, because there's a lot of different areas involved. And at we were all supposed to sign in New York in December, because George would be there for his Dark Horse tour. Paul and Linda would fly in for it. And we saw them a lot, so a lot of people didn't realize. We saw Paul and Linda a lot. And then Ringo had already pre-signed it. His lawyers told him he could pre-sign it because he didn't want to come to New York. There was a lawsuit going on. He didn't want to get subpoenaed. But he was standing by phone so that you could say, yes, it's me, I'm on the phone. And John. So all of a sudden, John's, as the lawyer's calling, the time is approaching, and John says, I'm looking at John and saying, I think we're supposed to go. And he goes, I'm not going to go. I don't want to sign it. I said, what? You're not going to sign it. I think I better make some notes here. So I called up and talked to the lawyer. He says, where are you? You're supposed to be here. I said, John's not going to come. He goes, and I heard silence. He said he doesn't feel comfortable. And there were some provisions in the contract he wasn't happy with. at the end, and he says he doesn't want to be the one, only one responsible for a few things because he's the only one in the U.S. So he didn't. So he went back. The lawyer says, "Okay." He goes back and he tells the room, and I'm telling you, a room, you have to figure this out. There is lawyers for the Beatles from England, lawyers, a set of lawyers from the Beatles representing them in America. There are the individual four guys and their four, you know, representatives. And then there is Apple on its own, which Neil and they represent. You know, so it was like, there's like 40 people in this room. And Linda's ready with her camera and, you know, the whole thing. And it turns out now Harold has to walk into the room and says, John's not coming. Well, George went into a fury. Just couldn't believe it. And he called up. And I picked up the phone. And I hear George. He goes, May. And I go, oh, hi, George. You want to speak to... No, I don't want to speak to John. He was so angry at him. And he told him, he said, listen. I'm not going to, you know, just tell him I'm going to do the show by myself, is basically what he said, because John was going to go on and perform with him. And John was listening in as well. And we sorted it out the next day, to make the story shorter. We sorted it out, and it was great. It worked out. We all went to the party at the Hippopotamus in New York. And I'm surprised to this day that there is no picture of George and Olivia at that point, and it was and Maureen was there because he was also dating Maureen at one point. So there was, and then Paul and Linda, and John and myself. Crazy. And there was no picture of us.
But that's kind of crazy. So it's like that was the end of the Beatles, but everybody was still willing to.
But yet he didn't sign it then. They had to redo the contracts.
Oh my God.
And in doing so, they had to do it. They had a time frame. They had to get it done before the end of the year. John and I were taking Julian down to Florida for a holiday, staying at Morris Levy's apartment. That's another one.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we were down there, and they finally got it done. And at the time that they got it done, we were visiting Disney World with Julian and everything. The lawyers came down, and we went to the Polynesian Hotel. And in the room, the lawyers came down, and the stack of papers came out, and I have the only pictures of John signing the contracts. And on top of that, you could tell the other three Beatles had already signed it there above, so his was the last signature. And I caught the picture in my book, in Instamatic Karma, is the last picture, and I'm lucky I caught it mid-signature.
It's amazing. So, again, people talk about the lost weekend, and you know, it was 18 months, it was this, that, but where was that moment that you knew that John and Yoko were going to become a couple again?
How about the day it happened?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, because the fact is, and John was not going back. Something happened in between. You know, she was in such a what kind of a frantic state. She wanted John to come over. She had to come. She goes, John, you got to come over today, and she was hounding him, and. And, you know, when you have a gut feeling that somebody's ready, and he was not. Because as he's walking out the door, he goes, I should be home tonight. She kept saying, I have a great method to help you quit smoking. It's hypnosis. Don't worry. You need to come today. It's today. And I just, you know, as a woman's intuition, you just say, I wish you weren't going. And he says, no, I'll be back by dinner. Listen, pick a restaurant. Let's go to wherever we're going to go, and then let's get the tickets to go down to see Paul and Linda down in New Orleans. That was our next thing. And we were signing for our house. We were about to get a house out in Montauk. And that whole weekend, it's just, that's what happened. And then I said, well, you know, he has a dental appointment on Monday, and you know he doesn't like that, to miss it. That was one thing. John was a big thing about going to the dentist. And we went there, and we saw each other, and we stood outside the door. And I saw something different in him that I didn't see before. And he goes, where are you going? And I said, I'm going home. And where are you going? And he goes, listen, we got to talk. And that's how it happened. So it was not something that said, oh, I could see coming. Because in the time that we're together, we were together a year and a half. Whereas it was not like, oh, a few weeks later, it's over. Because then you have a different perspective. So this is something that a year and a half later, and believe it or not, in the last 5 years of his life, we actually saw each other and was in communication. So it was not like as if we never talked again.
So
there was times where he just said, "I'm just, I wish we were still together." So because things are just not working out. In fact, in Larry Kane's book, Lennon Revealed, you actually see that he actually spoke to John, and John says, "Well," he says, he asked him, he says, "Are you happy? Because if you're asking me if this is the happiest moment of my life, it's because it was spent with May." So he goes, "And why aren't you back there?" And he said, "Because I'm too messed up."
We didn't spend a lot of time talking about the drunkenness or the troubadour or any of that, because it's been gone over a million times.
Not only that, people don't want to hear, they want to believe the myth, and that's not exactly how it happened. I mean, I was yelling and screaming at Harry to stop it, and he wouldn't stop it. And, you know, there is somewhere, I should find this article, and I remember reading where Jack Haley Jr., who was at our table, and everybody said, he goes, "Yeah," he said, "God, you know, Harry just wouldn't stop egging John on to doing it, and I'm screaming at the same time." And people see him as this drunk where he's, you know, there's a picture where everybody's seen where Harry's holding him back from jumping over to beat somebody. What people don't realize at that moment, John lost his glasses, and he's looking, and there's 1,000 flashbulbs going off, and this guy is coming at him. He can't see. He's nearsighted, and I could tell you he was very nearsighted. So if you can't see and someone's coming at you, you're going to start swinging because you don't know what's going on, and people are yelling at you. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible time. But at the same time, I read that Tommy Smothers is still upset from that night, and it ruined his night. I felt like saying, "You got more notice from that night than any other time you were out there."
First of all, before we forget, tell people about the book and what are you doing today? I mean, obviously you're doing the book and photography and all of that, right?
Yeah, I'm doing the book. I do photography. I'm doing the prints and stuff and whatever else I've helped out. I've been doing I'm a consultant, you know, in the music business, and I helped a lot of, you know, some film work, and, you know, when they get from music, they don't know where to go, because I was, again, in this business, it's who you know, and, you know, and if you're friends with them. So I helped out a few people there. It's been, you know, I have 2 kids I'm still raising, you know, and they're going to school, college kids, and I think most people would understand that. But I still, my love for music, I love film, but I would love to do more, like, because I'm really one of the very few that can actually go and talk about what went on in the recording studio, how it was the process. I watched John write. I've seen this whole thing go down. I would love to do more seminars, like to go around to colleges and things like that. I would love to do that. I would love to do theater and you know, what is it, dinner theaters, where you can sit there and just have a great conversation, and people can ask me anything they want. And I'm in the middle of rewriting my, starting rewrite of my, of the book, the original book, Loving John, because there was a lot left out.
So this is a great opportunity. What I do for the last half hour is I do a thing called a musical sandwich. Okay. And normally, with an artist, I pick 2 of their songs as the bread and things by others in between. Now, you have a rare opportunity here to pick, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 songs of anything you want. And it can be influential to what we're talking about, or it can be something that you know that other people don't know. You know, there's lots of rare opportunities here.